Buddhist Summer School, Monday morning, September 4th, 1978. Let us start this morning imagining we are scientists and mathematicians. The purpose of scientific research and of mathematical work is to discover and to penetrate into and discover the nature of things. Things as we experience them in our usual state of consciousness, through the use of the senses and the discursive mind. Note carefully the discursive mind. Intuitive perceptions play, of course, a very important part in the findings of the great scientists. We have to find out the truth of the nature of things in terms of the principles underlying phenomena and what we call the laws, or to use a more elastic term, the ways of nature. To study how things work. But we shall have to stretch our imagination a little further. As those who are concerned with religion in its deep and profound sense, we have to try to penetrate into and discover the nature of the no thing. Now, this is a very different matter altogether. But it is not only related to, but is rooted in the discovery of the nature of things. That is a fact we must never forget. Otherwise, we everlastingly separate the spiritual world from what we have been pleased to call, almost right up to our own times, as scientists, the material world. Now, for this, we need to observe clear-sightedly and critically. To work patiently and perseveringly, to be mindful, and above all, to be completely open-minded in our investigations. A large proportion of our work as scientists, as mathematicians, will be analytical, followed by synthesizing correctly what we have taken to pieces to find out the details. Note carefully that in the discovery of the nature of things, there is first the analytical process and later the synthesizing process using our discursive mind. Whatever deductions we make have to be logical deductions so that we can here present an intelligible, coherent picture in terms of concepts and words of that which we have discovered. But if when we extend that work into the realm of religion, which is the realm of transcendence, in which all this, which is the realm of things, is subsumed, then there is no synthesizing in the true sense of the word synthesizing, which is a putting together, forming a sankhara, as the Buddha would have said. Our task is no longer for us to synthesize, but to become one in consciousness with that integration, that living integration process, which is, to use the same word, the discovery of the transcendent. But the discovery of the transcendent is no discovery of an other something. It is oneself growing into and being that something. This is where the difference comes between us as scientists and mathematicians in the worldly context and in the profounder, all-inclusive context of religion and religious living and true human fulfillment. Just brood a few seconds over that, because we have to stretch our mental muscles quite a bit this morning. You know how the Buddhist analysis of the visible living person, the ordinary man as we call him, presents him as a group of skandhas. The word, I'm saying group of skandhas, but the word skandha itself means a group. And of course you know the names of the five groups: Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankhara and Vijnana. Now, as we touched upon Rupa yesterday, and we may quite rightly, from the Buddhist point of view, talk of Rupa as the group of the sensuous, all the senses operating. There is form and shape, not only where material things are concerned, but where our thoughts and feelings are also concerned. You see? And Rupa as such includes the sense organs, sense objects, their relationships and the psychological consequences. Vedana, translated as feeling, not exclusively sensation, remember, but as feeling, consists of the group of the feelings derived from sense impressions, as well as from emotions arising from inner causes, such as the feelings of pain and pleasure, which are bodily, sorrow and joy, which are mental, and of indifference and equanimity. Be careful of the word indifference here. it really means more a state of poise, where there is no reaction, no unbalance, no reaction from ourselves, no unbalance in ourselves. Then we come to sanya, the group of perceptions of discriminating awareness and representation. Sanya, comprising the reflective or discursive and also the intuitive faculty of discrimination. Intuition does play its part here. You know, I've again and again distinguished between intuition and between the translation of buddhi as intuition and the translation of buddhi, which I prefer myself, unerring insight. Buddhi is Plato's nous. It is unerring insight, you see. Intuition can be wrong, can be mistaken, but buddhi's activity is never mistaken. It is unerring insight. So, sanya consists of the group of perceptions of discriminating awareness and representation, comprising the reflective or discursive, the savichara, to use the Sanskrit word, and also the intuitive, the avichara, faculty of discrimination. Then we come to the fourth group, which is quite an important group, as we shall see later on, tomorrow perhaps. Samskara, the group of mental formations, or you may use instead of formations the word confections, which is quite a good meaning of samskara, and you'll see in a moment why. The group of form-creating forces or tendencies of will representing the active principle of consciousness, which implies, therefore, that they are the karmic consequences of conscious volition. This is what is meant by the samskaras. The element of conscious volition comes in very, very strongly. And I have written here the karmic consequences of conscious volition, because in the Abhidhamma 2 we read that one's karma, one's volitions are one's karma. Not that the conscious volition in itself is the karma, but it invariably produces a karmic, the conscious volition invariably produces a consequence. You see? And you may also regard the sankskara group of mental formations as the character of the individual. And finally, the fifth one, vijnana, the group of consciousness. Now note carefully, the group of consciousness which comprises, combines, and coordinates all previous functions, or represents the potentiality of consciousness in its pure, unqualified form. This group, the vijnana, ties up with the universal awareness. Now these groups are not separate parts, like the organs of the body, a liver and a kidney and heart and so forth. They are not separate parts composing an individual. Being functionally connected with each other, they are only different aspects of one indivisible process, to which neither the quality of being nor of non-being can be attributed. Now you see, the significance of all manifestation as a continuous becoming process in which everything is changing, is brought out here. This analysis of the person presents him as not composed of so many different bits and pieces, but as different aspects merely of one single indivisible process, to which neither the quality of being nor of non-being can be attributed. When we use the word being, we are aware of the meaning of that word in terms of an entity which remains a stay-put entity, always cognizable as such. If we take our ordinary physical experience in the world of solid objects, as we call them inanimate objects, they remain what they are. You can come into this room every day for the next 10 years and sit on this object which you recognize as that chair. It doesn't change. It remains a chair. In actual fact, scientific fact too, it is constantly changing. But the rate of change is so slow that we are unable to record it in our own consciousness or to perceive it even. The rate of change is very slow. But where the living being is concerned, the rate of change is much quicker. Therefore we can perceive it. And so the Buddha presented this teaching, that the quality of being cannot be attributed to anything which is sense-perceived. At the same time, there is no non-being. You can't attribute non-being to it, because in its process of changing, it is never annihilated. There is no annihilation. There is a steady transformation taking place there. See? When that transformation becomes a very drastic or a very dramatic one, death for the living creature, or being burnt up for the table or chair, you see, then it has transformed in such a manner that although there is no annihilation, there is no possibility of recognition of that particular person who is dead, I mean, well after he is dead and cremated, or of that table after it is burnt. There is no recognition possible anymore. And in the ultimate instance, in scientific terms, the atoms go back into the universal store of atoms. And the atoms themselves are composed, although chemically they are different from each other, they are composed of things like electrons and protons and neutrons and so forth. And any one neutron, whether it is in a gold atom or whether it is in a sulfur atom, is indistinguishable. It is as if the names of so many individuals have completely disappeared for identification purposes. They're all one and the same, like nuts and bolts coming out of the factory. Now, of these five skandhas, the skandha of vijnana is our special concern. The texts present six kinds of vijnana, the group of consciousness. Six kinds of consciousnesses now. The consciousness of sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch. In the original Sanskrit or Pali, the literal translation would be eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, and for touch, the tactile consciousness, it is body consciousness. It's rather interesting. They just say body consciousness for the sense of touch in operation. And these, of course, these consciousnesses are due to our physical senses. Now, there is another consciousness also, the sixth type of consciousness, which is called mental consciousness. Literally from the Sanskrit, mind consciousness, that is discursive mind consciousness. Not the pure mind, the absolute mind, the universal mind, but the discursive mind consciousness due to our inner thinking, feeling, activity. As a result of our experience, of our knowledge, of our memories, of our anticipations, of our urge of our desires and all the rest of it, an inner thinking, feeling process goes on. Planning, desiring this, that or the other, and so forth. You see? Now that consciousness, the mind consciousness as it is called, is termed mano-vijnana. You'll see the name there, on the left hand side, the big circle, the mano-vijnana. Now, this whole group of the six consciousnesses we regard as the empirical consciousness, because all this group is changing continuously. Now, the Buddha himself merely declared, he didn't attempt to give a logical proof or anything about it. He categorically declared the idea of a separate personal self or of an eternal unchanging individual ego to be an illusion. One can see quite simply and logically too that you can't have an eternal entity if entityness and identifiability of that entityness is to be present. Because an entity is something which comes into being, which proceeds, lives, and dies. That is why this is where the theistic religions, when they postulate a personal God as an entity in himself or herself, because there are still existing in the world matriarchal communities especially, which regard the supreme creator of the world as a lady, see. This is where the theistic presentation is so faulty, because you cannot present an entity which is inevitably, absolutely a mortal thing, a limited, finite mortal thing, as an eternal being. Can't do it. So, the Buddha taught that the idea of an eternal, unchanging individual ego is an illusion, and taught Anityatha, anitya in Pali. Anityatha. Now the Sanskrit nitya, which is the Pali nitya, means eternal. Eternal in the sense that it is not the opposite of temporal, but that in which the temporal is subsumed, and eternity is realizable only in terms of a profounder dimension of being and consciousness, which supervenes in you yourself in the profoundest state of meditation, of true samadhi. It supervenes there. See, then there is this realization of eternity of itself. Eternity realizes itself through the finite mortal being. So, he taught anicca, and it is translated as impermanence, which is not incorrect, but I think that a more helpful way of looking at it would be not to regard it as impermanence, because the word impermanence immediately raises up in our brains the opposite, permanence. But if we translate anicca as the relative, then we have perhaps a less misleading meaning to the word anicca. The relative. The relative is not the opposite of the absolute. The absolute being totally indefinable, nondescript, has no opposite. This is, it's only when some sort of sense of transcendence, some sort of experiencing of that dimension of being and consciousness which transcends our ordinary dimensions has been gone through by the individual, he gets that sense of transcendence. And he knows that the eternal, the absolute, has no opposite at all. It is neither permanent nor impermanent. The two are integrated in that profounder dimension of being and consciousness, of mind and consciousness. And therefore, the words eternal, the word eternal or the word the absolute subsumes within itself the temporal and the relative. In the realm of the relative, you have the play of the duals. When the duals are completely transcended, through the integration of the duals, remember, completely transcended by integration, not by a mechanical synthesis, then you have the absolute, you have the eternal. It is a little bit like this. There was a time when we didn't know that the earth was a globe. And to go northwards meant to go forever and ever in that direction. To go southwards meant to go forever and ever in this direction. But when we discovered that the earth was a globe, then we discovered that the north and south were no longer everlastingly opposites, everlasting opposites, but complementary poles of one great whole, then the separation disappeared. It's a little bit like that. Just a little bit. Analogies, you have to beware of analogies. Now, whilst the Buddha taught clearly that everything that we apprehend in our ordinary state of sense functioning and our sense consciousnesses and our logical discursive mind processes is anicca, he also taught that changeability is not identical with arbitrariness or chaos. Chaos in the sense of disorder now. It is changing according to the law of mutual dependence of phenomena. There is no fortuitousness in the real sense of the word fortuitousness in the Buddha's philosophy. And this is the meaning of causality in the Buddhist sense. It was also expressed in this manner. This being, that becomes. In the ordinary way, especially in our day and age, brought up as we are, to think of cause and effect as two separate things, you see, and the effect always in time after the cause, that is a misleading way of looking at it. This being, that becomes. That, therefore, depends upon this. But, the Buddha pointed out, that is, if that were not here, this also wouldn't be here. They are mutually dependent upon each other. Especially in the treatment of the Paticca-samuppada, you get this very clearly brought out. Each step, each nidana in the Paticca-samuppada is not the cause of the effect which follows in time afterwards, but it is an analysis of events, things, persons, processes in their wholeness, showing the interdependence of all the other parts with the one part, of any one part with any other part and with all the other parts. So you see, this sense of wholeness is present in manifestation which seems to deny the wholeness. Where comes the defect, the difficulty? It is in our own mode of awareness. We are conscious in such split-up terms that we cannot sense and be at one with the wholeness of the process. This is very important to realize. So, we have this law of mutual dependence of phenomena. That is why in the Mahavagga, the very first chapter, you find that the Lord, after the enlightenment, on the night of the enlightenment, went through the causative process, as it is called, three times in succession during the three watches of the night. You see, when you read it in cold print, it doesn't make a sufficient impression. But meditate upon it, meditate in the right way, let the mind be quiet and just picture the causative process, the terminology of it before you, and let it speak to one's own psyche, which is quiet, and then revelation will come of its true significance, its true meaning, and its actual operation in the universal process. Now, from this follows the dynamic nature of consciousness and existence. Like a river keeping up the direction of its movement and preserving its relative identity. Theravadins as presented in the commentaries on the Abhidhamma, called this stream Bhavanga Sota, the subconscious stream of becoming. Despite the continual change of its elements, its existence cannot be questioned because we are experiencing it constantly. Remember, it is the subconscious stream of becoming. Its factual reality consists in its continuity, santana, continuity, and in the steadiness and regularity of the relations prevailing within its changing components. The observation of this continuity gives rise to our self-consciousness. This is the origin of the self-consciousness, described by the Vijnanavadins as a function of manas, the seventh class of consciousness. Manas also means mind, you see. The seventh class of consciousness, Manovijnana, was the sixth class, as we see there, and manas itself is the seventh class of consciousness, to be distinguished from the mere coordinating and mechanically synthesizing activity of the sense impressions in thought consciousness, in Manovijnana. Manovijnana just synthesizes, the discursive mind synthesizes the sense impressions and makes an intelligible pattern out of it. The object of manas is not the sense world, but that ever-flowing stream of becoming or depth consciousness. Manas is the emanation and manifestation of the basic universal consciousness called the eighth or store consciousness, the Alaya Vijnana. The universal mind, Alaya Vijnana, transcends all limits and individuation. It is utterly pure in its essential nature, subsists unchanged and free from faults, for from the difficulties produced by anicca, by relativity that is, undisturbed by egoism, unruffled by distinctions, desires and aversions. You will find this in the Lankavatara Sutra, beautifully put forth. And if you look into Suzuki's translation of the Lankavatara and his introduction, page 22 and two or three pages following that, you will find a very fine resume of this teaching of the Lankavatara. So you'll see that manas, as an emanation of the basic universal consciousness, holds a very important position. Manas corresponds to neshama in the Kabbalistic teachings. Neshama is that in us which is the transcendent itself, Yahweh himself, embodied in the individual. Now, this diagram would help us to understand. Manas, therefore, can be regarded as that aspect of mind in us which is formed by the overlapping of pure mind, the Alaya Vijnana, the supreme consciousness, the supreme mind, and our empirical mind. Manovijnana, empirical or intellectual consciousness, sorts out and judges the results of the five kinds of sense consciousness. It is this which is followed by attraction, repulsion, attachment, aversion, and the illusion of an objective world to which one gets bound by action. Manas mediates between universal consciousness and our intellectual, individual, empirical consciousness, between alaya and manovijnana. It participates in both, as if universal and empirical consciousness were bound together in manas. Thus, manas on the one hand is a stabilizing element of the mind, but also it is the cause for the conception of separate egohood, insofar as it is bound up with empirical consciousness. In the unenlightened individual, who mistakes this relative point of reference as being really and permanently central in his personality, it is this aspect of manas, this imprisoned aspect of manas, which makes the person say, I am I. The Samparigraha Shastra calls this aspect of manas the defiled mind, the klishta manas. Defiled because it introduces the element of separate egohood. By contrast with the defiled mind, the truth-seeing aspect of manas, in the words of the Lankavatara Sutra again, is one with the universal mind by reason of its participation in transcendental intelligence, Arya-jnana, as it is called, and at the same time is one with the mind system, the five senses and the intellect, by its comprehension of differentiated knowledge according to the six classes of vijnana. When there is this comprehension, then there is no affliction in manas. Only insofar as manas sets up the idea of separate egohood in the experiencing process through the six consciousnesses, the sense consciousnesses as such, that it is defiled. Thus, manas either binds us to the world of the senses, if we just remain confined to manas, or it liberates us from it because of its touch with the transcendent, Neshama and Yahweh. It is the lump, the base metal of the alchemists, which has to be transformed into gold. You may regard it as the lump of coal which through magic power, siddhi, is turned into diamond, or poison that is transmuted into the elixir of life. The real magic, however, consists in the turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness, as the Lankavatara states. It is the turning away from the outside world of objects to the inner world of oneness, of completeness. It is an entering into the stream of liberation. It is the only miracle which the Buddha himself recognized as such.